Okay, well, everybody's more or less here and more or less comfortable, so I think we might as well get started. My name's Nicholas Rose. I'm the convener of the sociology department here, and I've got the honour and privilege of being the chair of this event, which, as you know, is a special lecture given by my colleague Leslie Sclair here, which is to mark his inauguration as Professor of Sociology at the London School of Economics and Political Science. And the lecture is going to be followed by a reception in the Senior Common Room, which, for those of you who don't know, is on the fifth floor of this building. And in case I forget to invite you at the end, can I invite you all very heartily to that after the lecture is over. This inaugural lecture is an event of celebration, but it's also tinged with sadness, as well as being an inaugural, it's also a valedictory lecture. That's to say, it presages Leslie's retirement at the end of this academic year, although I'm delighted to say that he's going to remain engaged with the school and with the department as an emeritus professor, I hope, for many years. Leslie has a long association with the London School of Economics. He was first appointed to an assistant lectureship in the sociology department of the LSE in 1967. He became a lecturer. I know he doesn't look that old. He became a lecturer in 1969, and so he's been teaching here in the school for 37 years. And in fact, his association is an even deeper one, because after an initial education at Eastwood Secondary School in Glasgow and taking a BA in Sociology and Philosophy from Leeds University and a Master's from McMaster University in Canada, Leslie read for his doctorate in sociology here at the LSE. And that doctorate was on the topic of the sociology of progress. And it was awarded in 1969, and it formed the basis of Leslie's first book, which was published by Routledge and Kegan-Paul, as they were then, in 1970. And that book, The Sociology of Progress, was followed by another called Organized Knowledge, which was published in 1973 and arose out of Leslie's research on the relations of science, technology, and society. Leslie subsequently researched questions of political mobilization in such diverse fields as extra-parliamentary opposition to the Housing Finance Act of 1970, I'm sure many of us remember those bitter struggles, and people's communes in China. And this led him to the focus on the sociology of development, where he worked on China, on Egypt, on Mexico, and on the Republic of Ireland. And these were the topics of a number of monographs. And they culminated in his sociology of the, quote, global system, and ultimately to his thesis on, quote, the transnational capitalist class, close quotes. A thesis which is now very familiar, not only to a wide international academic audience, but also is quite well known to his colleagues and students here at the London School of Economics. His book, A Sociology of the Global System, which was published in 1970, had a major impact worldwide and was translated into many languages, including Japanese, Portuguese, and Persian. It was followed by The Transnational Capitalist Class, published in 2001, and a third, revised and updated edition of the 1970 book was published in 2002. Have I got this wrong, Leslie?
Yeah, 91.
Sorry?
I know I'm a slow worker, but 20 years is a long time.
But your book was published in 2002 under the title Globalization, Capitalism and Its Alternatives, and is already in Chinese translation. Please correct me if I get anything of this ceremonial introduction wrong.
Sorry.
You know.
No, I'm really impressed.
Now, I've done my research here. Some of us are skeptics, it has to be said, when it comes to the concept of globalization, and even the concept, dare I say it, of the transnational capitalist class. But even us skeptics have to admit that Leslie himself is something of a global phenomenon, perhaps even a member of the entirely benign transnational intellectual class. Now, those of us who work with Leslie know him as a committed and passionate colleague, a person who's initiated and taught on many courses at undergraduate and postgraduate level, clear and often, or let's just say often forthright in his opinion of others, And yet, to his students, especially his many current and past research students from across the globe, the most caring and compassionate of supervisors, as the current director of the doctoral program in the Department of Sociology, I can testify to the caring and compassionate way in which some of Leslie's students have made their doctorates here at the school practically a life's work. Indeed, it's hard to think of him as approaching a retirement, as his engagement with research hasn't waned, and he's currently researching a new project on architecture involving interviews with major corporations around the world and focusing on iconic architecture, but to be more precise, about the role of iconic architecture for the transnational capitalist class. Given Leslie's engagement with transnationalism, it's not surprising then that in addition to publishing the books I've cited, several monographs and around 100 journal articles and book chapters, Leslie's given keynote and public lectures in countries from Greece to Argentina, from Mexico to China. So we're absolutely delighted to have him here tonight to give his inaugural lecture for his chair in sociology at the London School of Economics and Political Science on the theme, The Silent Qualifiers of Globalization. Leslie.
Thank you very much, Nick. By the way, if anybody wants to know what hires I got at Eastwood Senior Secondary School in Glasgow, just let me know. You neglected to mention my hires. Okay. First of all, as this is a sort of fairly, although it's supposed to be a very formal occasion, it feels to me like a very informal occasion. So I'd like to really welcome not just the LSE people, but all the my friends and relatives who've come here tonight. Let me start by explaining my slightly mysterious title, The Silent Qualifiers of Globalization. So mysterious that even one of my senior colleagues emailed me to say, what is a silent qualifier? Now, this is somebody who damn well knows what a silent qualifier is, but I'll let that pass. So silent qualifiers really relate to discourse. It's the way we talk about, think about, write about, and represent things. Now, if we start thinking about the silences in what we say, in how we write, in how we think about things, and how we represent things, then, of course, we're faced with an infinite variety of possibilities. So I'm not going to try to cover all the silent qualifiers of globalization. What I want to do is pinpoint three qualifiers of globalization, by which I mean that whenever you see the word globalization, whenever you hear the word globalization, or at least when I hear or see the word globalization, I immediately think, which sort of globalization are we talking about? Now, I want to focus on three silences in the discourse about globalization. The first is what I call generic globalization. In a way, this can be seen as the general abstract definition of globalization. Then I want to move on to the most common usage of the term globalization, and that is capitalist globalization. And when I write, boringly, I always try to indicate whether or not I'm talking about capitalist globalization. Because, of course, for many people and for many purposes, even raising the issue of capitalism is not recommended. So the silences of capitalism and capitalist globalization seem to me to be highly charged. And then thirdly, I want to talk about alternative globalizations. And these are specifically the alternatives to capitalist globalization, summed up in the title of that of the 2002 book, Globalization, Capitalism and Its Alternatives. So what is this generic globalization? I want to highlight four characteristics of generic globalization. The first and most obvious is summed up in the term the electronic revolution, which kicked in the 1950s and 1960s. So those of you who, like me, spend a lot of time reading about globalization and thinking about globalization will immediately see the chronology in which I operate. Some people see globalization as a motif for the whole of human history. Others see it as a project of modernism, or rather the modernity from the 15th, 16th, 17th century onwards. For me, and for other people, globalization is something specific that started to happen in the second half of the 20th century, about the 1950s and 60s. And the strongest argument for that is the relationship between the electronic revolution and its consequences for the mass media in particular, but also for all forms of production, distribution, exchange, and communication. The second characteristic of generic globalization I want to draw your attention to is what we can call the post-colonial situation. Now, I've got limited time and energy, so I just want to very quickly say, of course, a great swathe of post-colonialism, of decolonialization, occurred in the 19th century in Latin America. From the 1950s and 60s onwards in Africa and Asia, another and possibly somewhat different type of decolonization starts to occur. And debates about the post-colonial situation and post-colonial discourse started to really gather speed around that in the second half of the 20th century. Now, I don't have the time to elaborate in very great detail about the relationships between generic globalization and the post-colonial situation. Fortunately, there's a growing and brilliant, in many ways, literature developing around these themes. And if anybody is interested, we can continue that discussion in the discussion, if there is any. The third characteristic of generic globalization is what we can call transnational social spaces. The way in which generic globalization has started to shrink both space and time. It's one of these concepts that I won't say anything more about at this point, although I'll illustrate it in a moment, because if you start talking about it, you never stop talking about it, in my experience. The fourth characteristic is what I call new forms of cosmopolitanism. Now, cosmopolitanism is a very ancient concept coming from classical antiquity. And then Kant started another debate about it when he connected it with the quest for world peace. And this, I think, is maybe a third stage in the development of ideas about cosmopolitanism. But new forms which are connected with the way in which generic globalization operates. Now, as Nick suggested, or Nick said, my new research project, the wonderful thing about LSE, footnote, is they give you, they still have a great sabbatical system. So if you behave yourself, and you behave yourself, you get about 2 terms every 6 years. And if you really behave yourself, they sometimes kick in another term. And I was very well behaved in the last few years, so I got the whole of the calendar year 2004 to start my project on iconic architecture and capitalist globalization. So what I want to do to lighten this up a little is to call on my invaluable architectural mentor and tormentor, Connor, to show us the first number one. Page two, but number one. I'll do it on pages. So I want to illustrate the four characteristics of generic globalization in terms of my recent and ongoing research on architecture and capitalism. So the first, if you remember, first characteristic of generic globalization is the electronic revolution. How is the electronic revolution kicked in to architecture? Well, I think the answer is it's kicked into architecture like it's kicked into pretty well everything else. All processes of production and communication. Now, the best example, and why not use the best example, is the Toronto-born but working in LA architect Frank Gehry, who most of you will have already heard of as the creator of the Guggenheim Bilbao and lots of other buildings. So Connor has found for me three, in my view, great images from the Gehry website. The first is to show how architectural drawings, and this is an architectural drawing in PDF format, make the communication of architectural ideas and what researchers in foreign investment started to call the new international division of labor make it a reality for architecture. So stuff like this, and this is the proposed Guggenheim Museum in South Street Seaport in Manhattan, which hasn't got built yet and probably never will get built, and also the accompanying icons all around it shows how these images can be transferred electronically. Now, this is not surprising. I'm just illustrating this in terms of architecture. The second image, number three, is Rhino software for 3D manipulation. And this is Frank Gehry's unsuccessful, this doesn't often happen, competition project entry for the European Central Bank in Frankfurt. Now, what the electronic revolution in architecture has done is it makes prefabrication of very complex buildings quite possible. It reduces their costs and it enhances their quality, exactly as it does for the production of television sets, videos, motor cars, and all the rest of it. And quickly, let's go on to the third, to number four. This is CATIA software that Gehry has used, and this is from the aerospace software first developed in the aerospace industry for direct networking with factory production. And this is the representation of the design for the Museum of Tolerance in Jerusalem. So the electronic revolution and the new international division of labor and architectural design does all the things that I've spoken about, but also does something very essential for the capitalist mode of production. And that is, it allows you to do offshore production, the equivalent of offshore production. So just as motor car manufacturers can locate the production of the various different parts of motor cars all over the world, so can architects. So architects' offices in Australia, in the UK, in the US, in high-wage economies, can transmit their images, particularly to India. There's some very good research on the new International Division of Labour and Architecture between Australia and India. And this cheapens the cost. So the second characteristic of generic globalization, if you remember, was the post-colonial situation. And if we go on to the next image. Now this is the Petronas Towers in Kuala Lumpur, in Malaysia, which was, the architect was Cesar Pelli. Now this, looking at it like this, it just looks like any old skyscraper. But if we go to the next image, we find what we could even call the Islamic corporate style. So Malaysia, of course, is an independent country. It's no longer a colonial outpost. Now, why do we call this the Islamic corporate style, or do I call it that? Well, if you go to the Petronas Towers website, you'll see pictures like this, and the explanation that although this looks like just any old skyscraper, in fact, it's an Islamic skyscraper. Because the design of the floor plate, is based on geometrical patterns that are common in Islamic architecture. And if you look at what Cesar Pelli has written about it, you'll find that there's a very useful add-on, and that is that the design of the floor plate also gives you a little bit extra floor space, which is very helpful if you're trying to increase the rental value of the floors of these skyscrapers. Quickly on to the next one, which is the Jinmao Tower in Shanghai. This was built by SOM, Skidmore, Owings & Merrill, one of the top and biggest architectural companies in the world. And this is in Shanghai. And from a distance, it looks like any old skyscraper. But if you look at it closer, more closely, the architects want us to believe that this is pagoda style. I suppose it does have a certain pagoda quality about it. So it's not just any old skyscraper, it's got Chinese characteristics. And this is the sort of thing that I mean by the post-colonial relationship to generic globalization. Now, this again is a footnote, but I can't find anywhere else to stick it in properly into the talk. So I'll just, and those of you who know me, know that I will never miss an opportunity to draw a class struggle point out of any situation. So these are migrant workers sleeping in the scaffolding of the Jinmao Tower. And this seems to me, because when they brought in the migrant workers to build these skyscrapers in Shanghai, and this is one of probably 100 skyscrapers in Shanghai that's been built over the last 10 years that I could have used to illustrate it. But this wonderful picture from Sebastian Salgado, is he a Brazilian photographer? If you see him, so tell him I'm sorry I didn't get his formal permission, but I thought he'd like his picture to have this exposure here. When they brought the migrant workers in, they didn't have proper accommodation for them, and so many of them slept in the unfinished building. And this is another aspect of the way in which the post-colonial interacts with generic globalization, particularly, as I'll go on to argue, in its manifestation as capitalist globalization. Thirdly, I talked about transnational social spaces. And here, I think it's important to distinguish between transnational social spaces from above and transnational social spaces from below. It's probably a little too polemical to talk about the imposition of transnational social spaces. So I'll leave that to the side for the moment. But if we have the next one, yeah. This is the Shenzhen theme park. Now, when I first went to Shenzhen in 1975, and my first trip to China, I just could never have believed that 30 years later, I'd be using Shenzhen to illustrate an architectural point about globalization. That's how quickly things change under the forces of capitalist globalization. But in terms of generic globalization, let me just make the very simple point that here is your young Chinese tourist in the Shenzhen theme park with the Sydney Opera House and the Eiffel Tower in the back. What's the bridge? Sydney Harbour Bridge, okay. So, wonderful. You don't need to leave Shenzhen, which is a little special economic zone in the south of China adjoining Hong Kong, to experience global architecture. So in one sense, I think you can see this as a transnational social space. Next one. What's the fountain, Connor? Okay, some fountains. Anybody recognize the fountain? The Trevi Fountain in Rome? No. That was the three coins in a fountain. Anyway, don't worry. Maybe they just made it up to look like a fountain somewhere, which in a way really makes my point. There's the Arc de Triomphe behind. And so this Chinese tourist, we presume, is getting a whole global architectural education. Okay, enough indulgence. Let me go quickly on to the creation of transnational social spaces from below. Now, my best illustration of this, although I don't have an actual illustration of this, is in Statue Square in Hong Kong, where I've often visited with my beloved family. Now, what you find in Statue Square in Hong Kong on weekends are lots of Filipino domestic workers who, in a way, have made this space their own. They've created a transnational social space, a piece of the Philippines in Hong Kong. Now, of course, there are many, many examples of this. And some of them are benign, and some of them are not so benign, in the sense that in Hong Kong, the, quote, takeover of Statue Square, to my knowledge, hasn't provoked any nasty consequences. Whereas the takeover by minority groups, migrant groups, in other parts of the world, of social spaces in cities, often creates very negative responses. Again, a whole new field for research. Fourthly, let me look at new forms of cosmopolitanism. Now, I want to address this again in two ways. One is the creation of a whole social group within architecture, the people called Starchitects, the star architects. And I'll be talking a little bit more about them in a moment, because these are the people who, generally speaking, are producing the iconic buildings and spaces that my current research is focused on. But it's not just the individuals who are the new cosmopolitans, but also the sorts of things they produce. And here I want to, can we have the next? I want to draw your attention to a much less well-known, but extremely ironic rather than iconic example of new forms of cosmopolitanism as an illustration of this fourth characteristic of generic globalization. Now, this is the plan for the commune by the Great Wall, which has been built over the last few years in Beijing. And this image comes from the Venice Biennale. Was it 1999? Around about then. A bit later? Whatever. Now, the developer is a group called Soho China. And if you're interested, they have a great website. Now, what Soho China, a Chinese-based developer, did was to commission 12 different architects from various parts of East Asia to create this commune by the Great Wall. So if we have the next... So this is one example of it. And if we go to the next one, we see some stepped. Okay. Now, why do I use this as an example of new forms of cosmopolitanism? This is a, quote, Chinese development, which points up its Chineseness, that is, commune by the Great Wall, in this post-Mao period, and that's another story, of course, brings in a transnational group of architects and sells the units on the internet. Now, I think this tells us a great deal about this generic form of globalization that I'm talking about the way in which being cosmopolitan doesn't necessarily mean that you're universal and you are ignoring or rejecting elements of your own indigenous culture, which needn't necessarily be a national culture, by the way, but can be a regional culture or specific elements of political culture in this case. Again, if I had more time, and maybe on a different occasion, it would be very interesting to look at the rise of the modern movement in architecture in the 1920s and 30s, and the way in which this connected with nation building. I've just been reading a wonderful book about Turkish modernism and the struggles and dialectics of this. So, to cut this very long story short, let me just suggest to you that this analysis of generic globalization opens up these other two forms of globalization that I've been talking about. Whereas, in my view, ignoring these silent qualifiers and just talking about globalization closes down the proper analysis and research on capitalist globalization and alternative globalization. Now, there are lots of different ways to look at capitalist globalization. And just to clarify, capitalist globalization, what I mean by that is the actual historical form in which generic globalization manifests itself in the world today. This doesn't mean to say that it's the only globalization, but it is the dominant historical form. Of that, there is no doubt. And there are lots of ways to analyze this. My way is through the development of what I've called transnational globalization. That's a globalization that looks at capitalism not as a national project or as a completely and already realized global project, but as something different from either of these two. It's transnational because it clearly operates in a world in which there are still nation states which still operate in a variety of ways, but it's transnational because it transcends the old system of international relations and the old system of nation states. Now, in order to do this sort of analysis, I think it's necessary to develop new concepts, particularly new units of analysis. And my contribution to this vast field is the idea of transnational practices. And these are practices that cross borders, state borders, but don't originate with state actors, agencies, or institutions. And to cut a very long story short, and this is really the meat of the book that I first published in 1991, second edition in 1995, third edition in 2002, basically because my thinking on all of these issues changed quite a bit over that period, you'll be glad to hear, to analyze it in terms of economic transnational practices, political transnational practices, and what I call culture ideology transnational practices. And these are all fairly obvious, I think. Now, these economic transnational practices, political and culture ideology transnational practices, that's a very abstract idea. So it's very important to focus on what their characteristic institutional forms are in actually existing capitalism. So if we look at the economy in a transnational sense, then the characteristic institutional form of economic transnational practices, big mouthful, are the transnational corporations, which are the dominant institutions in the contemporary global economy. At the political level, there's a new concept which Nick referred to, the transnational capitalist class, and I'll have quite a bit more to say about that in a minute, so I won't say any more. But just to repeat, the characteristic institutional form of transnational practices at the political level are this transnational capitalist class. And then at the culture ideology level, the only culture stroke ideology which seems to me to operate transnationally in opposition to all the other cultures and ideologies that are floating around is the culture ideology of consumerism. You know, whether you're a Catholic or a Protestant or a Jew or an atheist or a Muslim or a Zen Buddhist, apart from the very fundamentalist fringes of all these groups, everybody is into consumerism. Except me, of course. But everybody else is. Me and the Pope. If you look at the Pope's website, you'll see some excellent arguments against what I would call the culture ideology of consumerism. Unfortunately, I haven't had a chance to discuss this with him. So, let's do some illustrations again. Now, I don't want to illustrate. Well, first of all, let's look at. I think we'll miss out the Shanghai seasons. That's 14 and 15. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Now, what I want to focus on, first of all, is the transnational capitalist class, which is made up, again, of four fractions. Something about the sociological mentality. It used to be triads in my Comtean and Marxist days, and although still Marx-influenced, I now seem to have evolved into quadrupeds, and maybe as I get more mature, I'll go into fives and sixes, and so on. Gets far too complicated. Four fractions of the transnational capitalist class. First of all, the corporate fraction, those who own and control the major corporations and their local affiliates. Now, the first overhead is the corporate fraction of the architecture industry, and that's a list of the 25 biggest corporations in the architecture industry. And you'll see that the top one has a fee income, roughly revenues, of $323 million. Now this, in global economy terms, is peanuts. Walmart, which I think is still number one, last year had revenues of above $200 billion. As those of us who keep an eye on these things know, in the last few days, Hong Kong and Shanghai Banking Corporation have announced profits, not revenues, profits of £9 billion this year. So these are tiddly little companies, but they're the dominant firms in the architecture industry, just to put it in context. Now the interesting thing to note is that if we go on to the next image, we'll find that the recipients of the Pritzker Prize, which is more or less the Nobel Prize for architects, since its inception in 1979, are listed here. Now, we couldn't get the two images side by side, but you have to take my word for this. Only two of these, what I would call iconic architects, and their iconic buildings, which are listed by the side, are in the top 500 list. And that's, if you go down to 1988, Gordon Bunshaft from SOM, who, strangely enough, shared the prize that year with the great Brazilian architect, Oscar Niemeyer. And then if we go to 1999, Norman Foster won it. Now, these are the only two on this list which are also on the other list. So one of the fascinating things, and one of the things that drew me to research iconic architecture, was that it was an industry which was slightly atypical in terms of the fact that the best known icons didn't come from this top group. I mean, if you're looking for the icons of consumer goods like Coca-Cola, McDonald's, Sony, and Toyota, and so on, they're all major corporations in the Fortune Global 500 list. But that's another story. So the fascinating fact is that most iconic architecture doesn't come from these big firms. It comes from small starchitects. The second fraction of the transnational capitalist class are what I call globalizing politicians and bureaucrats. And here, I've chosen a series of images to illustrate this. Can we have number 18? Because within architecture, one of the most interesting, and in fact one of the most dominant ways in which the transnational capitalist class has of expressing itself is through the marketing of major cities. Given that tourism and city branding have become so important in the service-oriented economies, particularly of the first world, but not exclusively. So if we run through this, we'll see this is the Empire State Building. No prizes for guessing that. The Eiffel Tower, yeah. Now, the reason why I presume most of you know the Eiffel, what did you say? Yeah, the reason why I did this was because there aren't that many cities which have got these recognizable icons. And one part of my architecture research is to try to discover how and to explain why these images are so important for the marketing of cities. Next one. So we know what that is. In fact, there's one icon. I know you can't go backwards, it doesn't matter. Big Ben is the architectural icon, and then the Red London Bus is a non-architectural icon, a number 12, for those of you who like to localize these things. Now, I just want to draw your attention to, again, another great and fascinating literature on such globalizing cities as Glasgow, Barcelona, Bilbao, Los Angeles, Shanghai. If we can go on to, that's the Disney Concert Hall in Los Angeles, which already, although it's only been open a few years, is being used in a major way to market Los Angeles. Beijing, Berlin, London, and of course Paris. And if we go on to the next one, and it's also very interesting to see the way in which new icons are produced. And the whole idea of the manufacture of architectural icons is of intense interest to me. Unfortunately, it's not that connected to the point I'm trying to make in my lecture, but you have to indulge me. Okay. But it is terribly interesting. The third fraction of the transnational capitalist class are what I call globalizing professionals. And I like to focus here on what I would call ideological entrepreneurs for architecture. And this is the case for all major industries. From Frank Lloyd Wright through the American-based architect Philip Johnson, who just died a few weeks ago, to Rem Koolhaas, the Dutch-based starchitect, we have a series of major and less major globalizing professionals in architecture whose job it is not simply through producing buildings but often simply producing ideas for buildings and writing about buildings and talking about buildings to somehow connect with the way in which capitalist globalization operates. And I see my time is almost up, so we'll quickly go through the fourth fraction of the transnational capitalist class, the consumerist fraction. That is, those groups whose main function it is to keep people buying. Now, in architecture, there's an obvious connection between consumerism and the buildings and spaces within which people buy. And I've chosen as my case study here, 1 minute case study, museums. Museums have changed their nature in quite a dramatic way in the last half century. From being simply rather dull repositories of paintings or artifacts, museums, to cut it very short and fine, have now become consumerist icons in their own right. And this is covered in another wonderful literature. It's wonderful how the literature in other subjects, apart from the one one is coming from, seems so wonderful. I don't know if some other colleagues of mine have that experience. But there's a great literature on the sculptural museum, museums as sculptures. The first one, the first and most notable one, which we don't have here, is the Guggenheim Museum by Frank Lloyd Wright in New York, opposite Central Park, which is personally one of my all-time favorite buildings. And when it was built, when the plans were released, there was a deputation of artists who approached Mr. Guggenheim and said, "You cannot let this madman, this megalomaniac Frank Lloyd Wright, build this building, because nobody's going to look at our paintings and sculptures. They're only going to look at the building." And they had a point, because of course it's a spiral, and it's quite difficult to hang most rectangular, one-dimensional paintings on a circular wall. So Frank knew what he was doing. Now, the first illustration of this, the Tate Modern, for which Herzog and de Meuron got the Pritzker Prize, doesn't suffer from this circularity. It is a wonderful space, and I presume most of you have already been in it. But the interesting thing for me about the Tate Modern, apart from the monumentality of the building and the wonderful art that it sometimes houses, is the buzz in the shops and the wonderful no-smoking restaurant. So it's become as much a consumerist space as it is an art space. Now, this is not some heavy-handed critique. I'm simply pointing out a phenomenon that that provoked a critic who commented, when the Victoria and Albert Museum was being refurbished, "It's going to end up looking like a great cafe with a museum attached." So many people in the art world, purists, are beginning to get a bit worried about the way in which the consumerist function of museums is overtaking their, quotes, purist function. Now, of course, for consumer goods, in the consumer goods industries, in capitalist globalization in general, this isn't a problem. But it seems to me to be a particular problem where there's a particular sort of aesthetic involved. So, I just leave you with some of these images. This is the Milwaukee Art Center by Santiago Calatrava. Connor, of course, found this image for me, and I said, "Connor, is this a real building? Or is this the computer rendering of it?" But he assures me it's a real building. The next one, well, I've never been to the Jewish Museum in Berlin. I haven't been yet. But again, what it contains in the literature and the controversy about it has been relegated to a poor second compared to the sculptural form of it. The next one, the same, the Guggenheim and Bilbao. And this, of course, also relates to the point I was making before about globalizing politicians and bureaucrats, because it was a connection between the globalizing politicians and bureaucrats of Bilbao and the Basque Country, their attempt to put Bilbao on the map was cost them $10 million, to put it crudely, because that's how much it cost them to get the Guggenheim franchise to build in Bilbao. And the jury is still out about whether that was money well spent. I mean, from the point of view of people who love wonderful buildings, it was money well spent. But maybe for the primary schools of Bilbao or the health services of Bilbao, I don't know. Okay, next one. Now, some of you may misidentify this as the Great Court in the British Museum by Lord Foster. In fact, it's the Great Shop in the British Museum. Because those of you who have the same similar aesthetic tendencies as me, sensitivity I'll probably better say, will realize that this is a wonderful space that's been completely ruined because the restaurant and the shop are just far too big for the space. Now, because I'm moving into the architectural world, if I was making a sociological judgment on that, I'd say that is what Weber would have called a value judgment. But as I'm moving into the architectural world, that is simply fair comment. And the next one is the Pompidou Center. So let's finish there. Okay, my time has run out, so let me quickly finish off. So even if this analysis is correct, that you've got generic globalization, which opens up lots of possibilities, and you've got capitalist globalization, which I've said a little about, what's the problem? What is your problem with capitalist globalization, you may say? Well, to cut a very long story pretty short, I think there seem to me to be two basic crises that capitalist globalization can not only not solve, but is intensifying. The first of these is what we can call the crisis of class polarization. That is the fact that more and more people are getting rich than was ever the case before in the history of the world. There are many, many more rich people than there ever were before. I'd not like to be able to say that really betrays my prejudice. It may well be the case that there are more and more people poor than there ever have been in the history of the world. Let's just say that the number of very, very poor people in the world has remained stubbornly constant, despite 50 years of development decades. And the research from the richest countries in the world, as well as the poorest countries of the world, is that the gap between the rich and the poor seems to be widening again rather than contracting. And this seems to me to be a crisis of class polarization. So all of these wonderful buildings and spaces that I've been talking about are being appreciated by more and more people who have the money to spend. But they still constitute a small proportion of the world's population. And there's no evidence that this is going to get any more equitable. In fact, the evidence suggests it's going to get worse as the so-called race to the bottom intensifies, which connects with the new international division of labor point of outsourcing jobs to cheap labor countries. And then when the cheap labor countries that have got the jobs become too expensive, as parts of China already are becoming too expensive, these jobs then go to even poorer parts of the world. The second crisis is less controversial, apart from in the Bush cabinet, and that is the crisis of ecological unsustainability. Now, these are medium to long-term crises. We'll survive tomorrow, the next year. My grandchildren, if I ever have any, probably will be okay. But, you know, if we're talking about globalization, we have to start thinking long term. So we need to start thinking about alternatives. Now, most of the debate about capitalist globalization, or just globalization, is highly fatalistic. there is no alternative. These are the parameters we have to work within. And I've always rejected this. And more and more people, it seems to me, in the anti-globalization movement and so on, are beginning to reject this. So what are the realistic starting points for thinking about alternative globalization when capitalist globalization becomes completely unsustainable, both socially in terms of the class polarization crisis and ecologically in terms of the ecological crisis, which could be 50 years hence, 100 years hence, who knows? Now, it seems to me that picking up on the tremendous surge of democratization in the world, and I'm not really talking about Iraq in this context, I'm talking about those political systems which have started to democratize themselves, that's again another huge debate. Now, not only does this wave of democratization doesn't only mean changing the conditions of governments and the transition from dictatorship to government, but it also means something about human rights. It means that the powers that be, all the way from major governments to the transnational capitalist class, those who own and control the major corporations, who have, generally speaking, taken economic and social rights quite seriously, because capitalist globalization, I believe, can only work properly and profitably when when civil and political rights, I better start that again. I'll finish in just a minute. Sorry about that. It means taking economic and social rights as seriously as the transnational capitalist class have taken civil and political rights. That is, there's been a tremendous global movement for democracy. Whether it's flawed or not flawed is another question. But even getting democracy onto the agenda is a big plus. When we start taking economic and social rights seriously as civil and political rights, then it seems to me that the foundations of capitalism and capitalist globalization will start to tremble in a way they never have done before. So, as well as saying to governments, you have a responsibility, as the UN Declaration of Human Rights said over 50 years ago, you have a responsibility to ensure that people have freedom of expression, can vote for political parties and so on. If we start taking economic and social rights seriously, this will mean saying to the major transnational corporations, you too have an obligation that no child in the community in which you're producing or distributing or selling goes to bed hungry any night. Always use children to pluck the emotional heartstrings of your audience. My 40 years of doing this sort of thing has taught me. But cynicism apart, it seems to me there is a strong argument to give responsibilities of economic and social rights, to lay these on those who run the global economy, as much as we lay on civic and political rights responsibilities to governments. So for me, this means taking democratic socialism seriously. You will have your own, if you've been in the least persuaded by this argument, you will have your own label for the alternative to capitalist globalization, but that's mine. And I'd just like to end up with one last indulgent image. And this I've labeled the dialectics of capitalist globalization. Visual space is essentially no owner. Now, this is a piece of neon art from the Lux Hotel in Rodeo Drive, Los Angeles. And the artist is a difficult to discover Eastern European. Now, why do I call this the dialectics of capitalist globalization? Well, I won't answer that question. But I'll ask myself two final questions. Can there be democratic socialist skyscrapers? Can there be democratic socialist transnational corporations? My answer to both these questions are surely yes, but certainly not under the conditions of capitalist globalization. Thank you.
To thank Leslie very much for a characteristically stimulating and controversial lecture. Is this going? We've got about 15 minutes for comments or questions from the floor to take up either some of the empirical bases of Leslie's theses or some of the provocative issues that he raised towards the end. So can I just see any questions? Well, maybe can I just ask one question to start with about this is always the question that people who talk about globalization, capitalist globalization as something that happens in the second half of the 20th century get asked. I mean, if I was looking at urban design, if I was looking at the building of civic architecture in the middle of the 19th century, and I was taking pictures in Paris, in Vienna, in London, in Moscow, I would find similar iconic buildings that showed remarkable analogies with one another, that used similar styles. Some of them were built by the same architects. They were definitely built for money. They definitely became emblems of their cities. So does that matter? That was capitalism.
Yeah.
I would say, because I'm a bit of a skeptic, as you know, about globalization, that actually there was a kind of globalization of architecture there. But does that empirical issue matter to your thesis?
Yes, I think it does matter. And the way I would address this is that I have an underlying chronological thesis for the architecture research, which probably also applies to some extent to the general issue about the chronology of globalization. And that is, just as I'm refusing the title globalization to what happened in the 19th century, because it seemed to me that capitalism was much more of a nation-state project, and the imperialism that took place was a nation-state imperialism. And I think, this is pretty clear in terms of the idea of British India, for example, or French Polynesia, and so on and so forth. That in the second half of the 20th century, capitalism changes its character. Now, how can we relate this to the point you very legitimately bring up in terms of city design? Well, it seems, and this is as it were, a working hypothesis, because frankly I don't know enough about it yet, having started off with the modern thing, the contemporary stuff, and I'm just getting into the pre-1950s stuff. But my working hypothesis is that whereas in the era which stretches from classical antiquity to the middle of the 20th century, most iconic buildings and spaces were driven by the deliberate interests of the state and or religion, and often the state and religion in collaboration. And sometimes you couldn't distinguish between the state and religion. Whereas in the period that I'm focusing on, post-1950s, most iconic architecture is driven by the interests of the transnational capitalist class, and that is the class that's in charge of capitalist globalization. So even though some of these buildings are state projects, they are driven by different sets of determinants and interests as in the previous era. If I had a long time, it would be interesting to go into the two counterintuitive examples. One is the Petronas Towers, which I illustrated there. Now, Petronas is the Malaysian state oil company. And the Petronas Towers project was really the brainchild of Mahathir, the Prime Minister of Malaysia. But what's fascinating about this is that it was the ideology and the discourse surrounding the Petronas project was, first of all, to build the highest building in the world, the tallest building in the world. There's a website called something like Tallest Building in the World, which changes quite rapidly as everybody, you know, is trying to build an even taller building. Now, what Mahathir was trying to do was to turn Kuala Lumpur into a globalizing city, in my terms, and put his project on the global map. And this was very much tied up with attracting tourists to Malaysia, attracting foreign investment, all part of a globalizing project. So Mahathir would be an excellent example of what I'm calling a globalizing politician. Now, the state, in my view, is a site of struggle. So I'm not suggesting that all politicians are like this, even in the contemporary world. But what's happening is that the globalizing the balance of power is switching from the globalizing politicians and bureaucrats and away from localizing and domesticating. And the same argument, I think, could be made for the Jin Mao Tower and all the stuff that's going on in Hong Kong and in China at the moment. And, of course, the race for the Olympics, to be an Olympic city, is also part of this whole general issue. Anyway, don't get me started on that, because I'm going to stop. Okay.
Yeah, I'll take one from the middle there.
Can I continue to play on this point, actually? In contrast with urban design, it sort of runs against Nick's comment, I guess, more or less, on my president's argument. And that is two very contrasting forms of urban design. You have to be on the sides of the planet alone. On the one hand, you have the remaking of Paris by Haussmann in the 20th century, which in Leslie's terms, the other side, you have La Défense, which is in the middle, of course. You have this great office block, an arch, yeah? And around that, you have the representatives of what were previously French national capital, but by sort of the 1970s, 1980s, the government has been transnationalized. And you have an urban space which is completely different from the rest of the city, which is it's alien.
Well, it's not very usual you support me, old friend, but that's very welcome. Let me just add one small thing here, and that is that the intentions of the people who are building are not always met by the actual impact of the building of the space. That the buildings and the spaces can be transformed in their meanings by events, and sometimes by being taken over, for example, by groups for which they weren't initially intended. There's some fascinating research on shopping malls and the way in which some shopping malls, which are basically enclaves for people with money to spend, have been taken over by disparate groups, all the way from skateboarding kids to old ladies going for their organized walks, exercise walks. And so this is also some fascinating potential for research into this relationship between iconic spaces and capitalist globalization.
Right. Yeah, in the middle there.
Could I ask you to, sorry, we don't have roving mics, so could I ask you to maybe,
we do have a roving mic, yeah, thank you.
My name is Ian. Thank you, first of all, for pictures, because I'm not an academic, and the pictures really help the sort of no-brainers. So many things that are interesting, and I've got a couple. One is a trick question, one a genuine question. The race to the bottom...
Can you make clear which one is which?
This is slightly tricky. The race to the bottom, which is a phrase that I've heard in different contexts, Do you mean trying to build the tallest building in the world just because it's tallest is a race to the bottom aesthetically or economically? But more importantly, when you compare the Guggenheim with the Tate Modern, I have a lot of trouble, because one is an example of urban renewal.
Which Guggenheim? The Bilbao?
Yeah. No, well, both, either. Right. One is an example of what I understand as urban renewal, state project. The others are showbiz, they're movies.
Okay, I'll treat the race to the bottom one as the trick question, so I won't try to answer it. But the point you bring up about urban renewal is very, very important, because, for example, there's a lot of stuff on waterfront redevelopment. And of course, in Bilbao and the Tate Modern are both waterfront redevelopments, which are in which were in relatively unfashionable districts in their cities, and are now both on the global map. And I mean, the other fascinating thing about this is the relationship between these starchitects that I was talking about, who exemplify this new form of cosmopolitanism I was talking about, and they're often also called signature architects, in the sense that they do buildings which seem to be, although an architect will be able to tell the difference between, say, Gehry's Guggenheim in Bilbao and the Disney Concert Hall, even a non-architect, after a year of looking at this stuff, I can now tell the difference between these two buildings, although they look quite similar. The signature is still there, precisely because to the untrained eye, they look, people will say, that's a Gehry, or that's a Bilbao, or that's a Calatrava, or that's a Foster, and so on. So what's being bought in by cities who want to do themselves up, and they, of course, they do themselves up for reasons of capitalist consumerism on a global scale, is not just making a nice new building in a previously horrible part of the city, but connecting to this global network of iconic architects who are doing the rounds. Now, whether this is something which is reserved to a very small intellectual aesthetic elite, and therefore not terribly interesting in terms of capitalist globalization in the round, or whether it's something that's entering the zeitgeist, more and more people are beginning to cotton on, is an interesting question. And I think the latter. I think, and it's connected to this theme of class polarization, that we're now getting to the point in many, many societies, even poor, quite poor societies, where the absolute number of very rich people, and that, of course, will differ from society to society, what's counted as very rich, who are not just very rich in terms of having a car or having a mobile phone, but also having a repertoire of cultural signifiers. That absolute number is getting sufficiently big that there's an audience in most biggest cities in the world, even in quite poor countries, for this sort of discourse and also for these sorts of buildings. And it is fascinating that a tremendous amount of the new iconic architecture is happening in what we used to call the third world, or the old second world, China, for example. And less of it is happening in the heartlands of the rich first world. I mean, there's quite a bit. But it's interesting that the balance of power is switching, particularly in this skyward trend of thought, to quote the title of a very good book on the subject. And I'll leave you to work out what the implications of this are. Okay.
Can you take a couple more? We have
no, let's finish.
No, we have one more question here. After, yeah.
I'm really tired. Okay,
okay,
an easy question.
We have one more question here, and then we're going to...
Robert Wade. I'm going to shift away from architecture to your more general argument about globalization. I wanted to ask you, what sort of agency do you see for pushing towards your project of an alternative globalization? Who is going to do the laying on of economic and social rights onto states that you talked about? And in particular, do you see any scope for generalizing the kind of global governance mechanism that has been developed in the ILO over decades, whereby the ILO is governed not just by representatives of states, but by representatives of states, business, and of labor, and the member states have mechanisms inside themselves to select the representatives of business and labor to go and be representatives of their functional economic group on the ILO. Is that a possible mechanism, or what do you have in mind?
Well, I'm glad you asked me that question. The major agency I have in mind, and you will no doubt condemn me as a naive utopian optimist, is the ballot box. There's nothing stopping us voting for good progressive politicians who represent the interests of the best, most just, and most humane elements of society. Now, at the moment, that does sound absurd. But I am an incurable optimist. And I think eventually some good people are going to get into political power in some big, powerful countries. And I suppose in my scenario, this will coincide with some of the more nasty consequences of class polarization, frightening ordinary people who would never think about these alternatives, as well as ecological unsustainability, starting again to frighten people into looking for genuine alternatives. Now, as I said, this is a medium to long-term project, and it'll take a lot of people of goodwill. There are some places in the world where things are starting to happen. It would be invidious of me to name them, because it's not all good. And you may quite correctly respond by saying, well, fascist dictatorship is probably the most likely consequence of class polarization crisis and ecological unsustainability crisis. And maybe you'd be right. But I think by offering these alternatives, and you know, although I'm no longer very politically active, that I mean by that I'm a member of the Labour Party. I do feel in a modest and small way that simply giving an airing to these subjects is a small contribution. It'll take a lot of hard work and a lot of people of good intentions to make a difference, to make a change, but I don't see any other way. A ballot box.
Well, speaker's privilege is to decide when our business session this evening should stop. Just before I remind you all that we're going to have a reception upstairs, the fifth floor in the senior common room, where you'll have a chance to talk to Leslie informally, I should just say a couple of words. I said at the beginning that Leslie had been teaching here in the school for 37 years, and I think in this terrific lecture and answers to the questions tonight, we've got some sense of what Leslie's students, generations of undergraduate and postgraduate students, and Leslie's colleagues have experienced and benefited from, however much they may have been provoked or provoked into disagreement over those 37 years. As I said also at the beginning, it's a great occasion, an inaugural lecture, and that was a great inaugural lecture, and I thank you for it, Leslie, an honour, I hope, to the school and to the department, as well as to your chair. It's also a moment of sadness because you've given so many lectures in the school that it's quite difficult to think that you won't be giving any others, at least as a paid member of staff. But I'm delighted to say that as an unpaid emeritus professor, we will extract as much surplus out of your labour power as we can over the next years. And with that, thank you very much. Thank you.